You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network with your host, Dan Gould. On Thursday, September 27th, 2012, Rick Britton presented the fourth and final lecture in our series entitled Virginia History 301, The Old Dominion in Antebellum Times. The date is June 27th, 1850, when the first train rolled into Charlottesville, says Britton, in this fascinating podcast. Rail passengers of the time could travel from Richmond, Virginia, to Charlottesville in just 12 hours, says Britton. Listen as he tells the story of the early railroads of Central Virginia and of Claudius Crozet, the brilliant engineer who created the world's longest tunnel through the Blue Ridge Mountains. Britton, an award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer, organized the series in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. This is the fourth and final part of this series. Here's Rick Britton.
We're going to be talking about the railroads of Central Virginia, and in the process, we're going to take a sidebar off into another major transportation system so that we understand really the fight that went on between the railroads and this other system. And you can probably guess what this other system is. It must have been quite a spectacle. Imagine the noise as the monster machine ground its way up the hill from the river, wheels struggling with the newly laid rails. And the smoke, huge cotton bale clouds of smoke roiled up from the stack with each stroke of the engine. When it chugged past a cluster of residences, it acquired a welcoming committee of sorts. Young lads running alongside yelling, their dogs yapping at the escaping steam. These sounds soon hit the commercial district, and the news spread just like wildfire. Now business was stopped altogether. Shop doors slammed shut as the proprietors, throwing on their frock coats in mid-stride, hustled down to the freshly painted depot. The little town of Charlottesville was about to greet its first train. Does anybody have any idea what year that was? What, 19? 18. 18. 1840, you guess? 1848? You're closer. The date was June 27th, 1850. Kind of late when you think about it. Kind of late. She said 1850? Very good. Okay. When the railroads arrived in Central Virginia, the flow of goods to market was forever altered and improved. Prior to their arrival, Piedmont farmers relied on two methods of transporting their produce, rivers, two of which in Central Virginia, the Rivanna and the James, had been improved by canal systems and, of course, the roads. Virginia roadways, however, had long been ridiculed as unreliable. Some still do ridicule them. Their badness was a joke when they were at their best. This went the familiar quip. And a calamity when they were at their worst. Rivers and canals were adversely affected by floods. Bridges were relatively few, meaning that both farmers and travelers passing through Central Virginia were often confronted with fords. Fords of unknown depth and unknown reliability. Many a wagon load of produce, think about this, many a wagon load of produce or a coach load of unsuspecting passengers was mired by mud or dumped into the swirling water. Not a happy thing to happen. This happened to Thomas Jefferson, by the way, coming across a ford. This newly fangled device, however, this steam-driven monstrosity, seemed more dependable. And in time, its wide-ranging significance would become apparent all across Central Virginia. Where the iron rails went, so went growth and prosperity. The first railroads were mainly short lines financed by the individuals living along the tracks. And remember now, I'm talking about Central Virginia. The individuals who could benefit the most from this new form of transportation. The first to lay tracks across Central Virginia was the Louisa Railroad Company, chartered by the Virginia General Assembly in 1836. From Hanover Junction, 21 miles north of Richmond, where it joined the Richmond, Fredericksburg, and Potomac, or RF&P, the road, the Louisa Railroad Company, ran west into Louisa County. The little line was created to carry tobacco and wheat from that locality to the markets in Richmond and beyond. Its progress west was dictated, of course, by terrain. A study by the Virginia Board of Public Works had determined that if the tracks were laid along a ridge between the Little and North Anna Rivers, no rock excavation would be needed. From Hanover Junction, the rails were completed to Fredericks Hall on December 20, 1837, a distance of approximately 20 miles. To celebrate, a party of state officials rode by rail from Richmond to the new depot in Louisa. A newspaper man marveled that they had traveled 15 or 20 miles an hour with as much comfort on a winter's day as if we were sitting at our own firesides. And I need to mention here that a common scientific theory at the time, I think I told my group yesterday, we went to Brandy Station, common scientific theory at the time limited the rail of travel to under 22 miles an hour. Any faster speed, they reasoned, and we're talking about scientists now, would suck all of the air out of the passenger cars and thus suffocate all of the passengers. So much for mid-19th century science. And Fredericks Hall soon gained further significance. From that point, passengers could connect to stagecoach lines that were operating further to the west. An 1838 advertisement by the Louisa Railroad Company boasted the unrivaled line the organization had with Charlottesville, Stanton, and the Virginia Springs. It read, "Passengers for Charlottesville take their seats in the mail train, both from Fredericksburg and Richmond, at 5 o'clock a.m. and arrive at Frederick Hall soon after 10 o'clock, having then only 44 miles of stage traveling over an excellent road. They arrive in Charlottesville by or before dark, thus accomplishing the whole journey by daylight in one day, from Richmond to Charlottesville in only 12 hours, a miracle of modern technology." 12 hours. On a good day. Yeah. Within 10 years, the line stretched from Tollersville, Louisa Courthouse, and Trevilian Station, to Gordonsville in Orange County. And business was good. Passenger fare in the 1840s was 8.5 cents per mile. That's all you paid. The freight charge was 10 cents per mile per freight ton. Receipts for the first 16 years of operation totaled $14,000. In 1844 alone, the receipts were $40,000, really going up. One very happy customer noted that rail charges for shipping his wheat were 12 cents cheaper per mile on the railroad than by wagon. So there you go. Thus ended those freight companies who were hauling stuff with mules and wagons. Thus far, I've painted a picture of technological acceptance, of an Old Dominion witnessing the advance of this newfangled machine, recognizing its vital importance, and greeting its arrival with open arms. Since this is not entirely correct, we need to stop briefly and get a broader view. Here we're going off into a sidebar. In mid-19th century Virginia, the state's Board of Public Works was expending much money on improving another earlier form of transportation. Did anybody guess what this earlier form was? Yeah, the canal system, right. In particular, the James River and Kanawha Canal. The James River and Kanawha Canal was a project first proposed by George Washington when he was a young man serving the mountains of West Virginia. And of course, in those days, Western Virginia included modern-day West Virginia and Kentucky, of course, along the western and northern borders of which flowed the powerful Ohio River, and still does. We hope it still does. You know, it's really funny. Let me just mention for a moment, it's really kind of tricky when you talk about terrain and things that haven't changed, and you talk about them in the past tense, and usually what historians do, what writers do, is they switch to the present tense, because obviously the Ohio is still there. Washington was searching for a water route to the west. He believed that was the key to helping Virginia maintain its prominence relative to its neighbor states. In November of 1784, Washington appeared before the Virginia General Assembly to promote an act for clearing and improving the navigation of the James River. The James River Company was born 2 months later with George Washington as its president. The history of the James River Company and its many permutations is full of grandiose plans backed by insufficient funds. And really, that's the story of government, isn't it? Grandiose plans, insufficient funds. Originally, unfunded mandates, we would say nowadays. Originally, the company was charged with cutting canals, erecting locks, and opening, improving, and extending navigation above tidewater to the highest part thereof to which navigation can be extended. A long, direct quote. This was necessary because above Richmond, the James was only navigable by canoes, rowboats, or bateaux, things that didn't draw a lot of water. By survey, the highest part to which navigation can be extended was determined to be Crow's Ferry near Buchanan in Botetourt County. That's in the Shenandoah Valley. Eventually, according to the grandiose plan, and here comes the grandiose plan, that point on the upper James in Botetourt County would be connected via a turnpike to the Kanawha River, which flows past Charleston into the Ohio River at Point Pleasant. Thus, goods from the Ohio Valley could be poled up the Kanawha, transported on wagons via the turnpike to the James River, floated downstream to Richmond, and from there to eager European customers. These valuable Ohio Valley goods would thus make Richmond one of the eastern seaboard's most important transshipment points. During the next 35 years, the company constructed a canal around the falls of the James River and cleared obstructions from Richmond to Crow's Ferry. 35 years. They deepened the channel by dredging, knocked down dangerous rock ledges, and constructed wing dams to raise water levels. Some of the branches of the James, including the Ravana, were also cleared. It was a good beginning, but after work stalled for a number of years, the canal company went broke and gave up. In 1820, the Commonwealth of Virginia took control of the James River and Kanawha Canal and resumed construction. It received the financial help of state funds through Virginia Board of Public Works. Work stalled yet again, however. Construction was resumed in 1835, and by 1840, the canal was complete all the way to Lynchburg. Service was inaugurated by William Henry Harrison, who was elected president that same year. Pretty amazing, huh? The canal eventually extended 196.5 miles west of Richmond to Buchanan, but that by 1851. So what's the point of all this? And how does this relate to the railroads? The completed canal was a boon to transportation in the Old Dominion, but all of this stopping and starting of construction on the project had put this most important of Virginia canals way behind canal systems in other states. The Erie Canal, for example, in New York, had opened for business in 1820, way back in 1826, the year Thomas Jefferson died. And by that time, literally dozens of other smaller New England canals were already in operation. And this is a classic study of the incompetence down here. Up in the north, they got into the canal age early and completed stuff early. Down here, it took us way too long. Moreover, and more importantly, in Virginia, another transportation system was injected into the situation in 1827, the year the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad was incorporated. The arrival of the age of steam necessitated the making of a decision here in Virginia as to whether travel by rail would be preferable to that by water. This meant, of course, that Virginians had to also rethink the James River-Kanawha Canal. Should the two rivers be connected by rail rather than a turnpike? Should the entire project be scrapped in favor of a rail line all the way to the Ohio? The B&O Railroad, incidentally, was granted permission to cross Virginia territory, but only after considerable objection here in Virginia, since some powerful Tidewater individuals wanted to keep the railway out of the state. There was apprehension lest it divert business to Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York, and away from Tidewater Virginia, which, of course, is exactly what ended up happening. In what became a legislative fight between Eastern and Western Virginia, led by powerful individuals in Norfolk and Richmond, much advice was given to the legislature by the Frenchman, who had been serving as the state's principal engineer since the 1820s, Claudius Crozet. And we'll hear more about him, a lot more about him, very shortly. He proposed that the state put more money into the new technology, steam-powered railroads. But the important towns located at all, and here's the kicker, the important towns located at all of the fall lines of Virginia's numerous large rivers, Richmond on the James, Petersburg on the Appomattox, Fredericksburg on the Rappahannock, Alexandria on the Potomac, all of these towns wanted to continue the emphasis on rivers and canals. Their citizens, like many other Virginians, failed to realize that with the invention of the railroad, a new era had dawned. This short-sightedness kept Virginia behind other states in the matter of building railroads, and it also focused what construction was done on shorter rail lines. Meanwhile, in the late 1840s, large work gangs of Irish immigrants began laying the iron rails further westward into central Virginia. Cobham Depot in Albemarle County was reached by the Louisa Railroad in August of 1848. Within 5 months, the tracks were extended 7 miles further to Shadwell, birthplace of Thomas Jefferson. Interestingly, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, the ex-president's grandson, was supervising the construction. Soon thereafter, long iron bridges were built over the Rivanna River and Moores Creek, 200 feet and 350 feet long, 354 feet long, respectively, alongside the crossings for Three Chopped Road. Regular service to Charlottesville began in 1850, the same year the Louisa Railroad changed its name to the Virginia Central. Prosperity followed as corn and wheat from Albemarle, one of the state's most productive counties, began rolling east on the iron rails. County land values increased. Within 3 years, the population of Charlottesville rose from 1,900 to 2,600. That's quite a jump back then in 3 years. Enrollment grew at the University of Virginia. As Charlottesville gained in importance, Scottsville began its decline, as did shipping on the James River Kanawha Canal. But the railroad craze in the Piedmont had just begun, and the race was on to connect the Shenandoah Valley. In October of 1852, the westernmost depot of the Virginia Central was Meacham's River, 9 miles west of Charlottesville. 2 years later, the first engine struggled over the Blue Ridge Mountains, over on temporary tracks. Permanent rails weren't required because a miracle of engineering was being supervised through the very bowels of Afton Mountain below. In charge was a French veteran of Napoleon's army, Claudius Crozet. Claudius Crozet was typical of the class of well-educated Europeans attracted to our nation in its infancy. He was born in France during its turmoil of revolution and educated by its most modern curriculum at the time. Crozet was a thoroughly trained engineer at a period when that training was universally in demand. As principal engineer of the state of Virginia, Claudius Crozet left his indelible mark on our rivers, byways, and railroads. One of his last projects was indeed a marvel of the 1850s. Crozet's three-quarter-mile railroad tunnel at Rockfish Gap in the Blue Ridge Mountains was one of the great engineering accomplishments of its time. Crozet was born Benoit Crozet, and you know, here come a lot of French words, and I'm probably going to mispronounce all of them, so please excuse me. Crozet was born Benoit Crozet in Villefranche, France, on December 31st, 1789. Villefranche was a walled manufacturing town nestled in the rolling hills between the Morgon and Saône rivers. His parents were François Crozet, a wholesale wine merchant, and Pierrette Varillon. Little is known of his youth. Soon after reaching his majority, he dropped the name Benoit in favor of his Christian name, Claudius. It was common after the French Revolution for a citizen of France to take on the name of a well-known Roman. That's something I didn't know. Later in life, most of his friends would refer to him as Claude. Not as nice as Claudius, I don't think. Crozet's native land was torn apart by revolution and war throughout his early years. With the French Revolution, however, came a revolution in schooling that greatly benefited him. During the government of the Committee of Safety, a central school for public works was founded in Paris. On October 14, 1795, it became a two-year preparatory school from which students graduated to special schools of application. In December of 1799, the School of Public Works became the famous École Polytechnique, or Polytechnic School, which would produce an elite officer class for Napoleon. The emperor, in fact, referred to the École Polytechnique as the hen that lays for me golden eggs. The careers of its many famous graduates more than verified Napoleon's esteem. Claude Crozet began his term as cadet at the École in November of 1805. In October of 1807, he was graduated and commissioned sub-lieutenant. Claude continued his education with 2 years at the School of Application for the Artillery and Engineers. The school was located in the fortified city of Metz in the beautiful Moselle Valley. On June 9, 1809, Claude Crozet graduated with a commission as second lieutenant in the battalion of Pontaniers. These 4 years of intense study became the foundation for a lifetime of productive work. France was still at war in 1809, so naturally young Crozet decided to remain in the military. Claude Crozet took part at the Battle of Wagram, and in 1812, during the invasion of Russia, he witnessed the Battle of Smolensk and the horrible carnage at Borodino on September 14th. He was captured in the disastrous retreat from Moscow. And let me just give you, I don't know a whole lot. I know a little bit about the invasion of Russia, but just keep this in mind. Napoleon's army that invaded Russia was 500,000 men, 500,000 men. Only 1/10 made it back. 50,000 came back. Talk about horrific. Always true to his studious nature, Crozet spent his 2-year imprisonment composing discourses on the Russian and German languages. What a guy. Crozet returned to the French army during the Hundred Days, but luckily he missed the Battle of Waterloo. Lucky for him. As a child of the French Revolution, Claude Crozet could not imagine a France without Napoleon. He resigned as captain of artillery in 1816 at the age of 26, and like so many other disillusioned Frenchmen, he knew his future lay elsewhere. On June 5, 1816, Crozet married Mademoiselle Agatha de Camp. Within days, they embarked for America. By a stroke of good luck, a fellow passenger was French engineer Simon Bernard. This colleague in science helped Crozet secure his first employment in the United States. On September 14, 1816, he was appointed assistant professor of engineering. Where, Walt?
West Point.
At West Point. The administration of the military academy was pleased that Crozet intended to follow the methods of instruction used at the Polytechnic School. During his tenure at the academy, he introduced into the curriculum quite a few French military treatises. But think about this for a moment. Here's a veteran at this point of wars who's seen combat with all these young guys that are just going into the military. So think about that for a moment, and this next sentence makes so much sense. But it was Crozet's wealth of combat experience that excited the young pupils. The anecdotes with which he illustrated his teaching were far more interesting, wrote former student John H.B. Latrobe. Far more interesting than our textbooks at the time. Latrobe described Crozet as a tall, somewhat heavily built man of dark complexion, black eyes and eyebrows, deep-set eyes, a rapid speech, and strong French accent. Crozet remained at West Point until 1823. That year, he accepted the post of principal engineer to the Board of Public Works for the state of Virginia. The board had been set up by the General Assembly on February 5, 1816, for the purpose of internal improvements. The duties of principal engineer included surveying streams for navigational improvements, laying out highways, and managing the many companies in which the board had invested state funds. In 1830, when charged with devising the most efficient transportation up the James River to Lynchburg, so I'm kind of coming back to what I told you earlier, Crozet proposed the newfangled railroad technology over lock and dam navigation or a continuous canal. And here's a direct quote. "A railroad is undoubtedly the system I should prefer," wrote Crozet. "And if Virginia is prepared to expend $3 millions of dollars upon an improvement up to the mountains, it is certainly not a canal that I wish to see them applied to." But Virginia wasn't ready for the railroad, as I've already told you. Too many well-heeled proponents of continuing the canal system sat in the Virginia legislature. Disappointed and disgusted, Crozet submitted his resignation on October 28, 1831, and moved to, does anybody know where he went?
Crozet.
Nope. Good guess. Good guess. That's a good guess. No, Louisiana. A lot of French down there. Claude Crozet secured the same position with the state. That was a good answer. With the state of Louisiana, but the attraction to Virginia was too strong. Crozet returned to Virginia and again held the position of state engineer between 1837 and 1843. While working on internal improvements, he also became involved in the formation of a military school to be established at, well, Lexington. As president of the Board of Visitors, Claude Crozet was essential to the organization of the VMI. At the end of his second term as engineer, he returned to teaching. He became principal of the Richmond Academy and published a series of mathematical textbooks. And I happen to know that, well, earlier at West Point, Robert E. Lee, I'm pretty sure, studied under Claude Crozet. In March of 1849, Claude Crozet was again called upon to serve the state of Virginia as principal engineer. By this time, railroads were already under construction in the Old Dominion. Crozet's main task, and the one for which he's best remembered, here we go, was the drilling of a railroad tunnel through the Blue Ridge Mountains at Rockfish Gap. The Blue Ridge Tunnel, it was called when completed, but completing it would cost an immense amount of labor, a pile of money, and literally dozens and dozens of lives. The Blue Ridge Tunnel would allow the Louisa Railroad to connect Stanton, and thereby the Shenandoah Valley, with the eastern part of the state of Virginia. Claude Crozet was well familiar with the Louisa Railroad. In 1839, they'd sought his advice in laying tracks over the Blue Ridge Mountains to Stanton. Crozet had recommended that since the incline seemed too steep for trains, they should instead burrow through. So here's a guy continually suggesting what people eventually end up doing years later. The first railroad, the suggestion at the time was far too visionary. The first railroad tunnel in the world had been dug in England only 10 years earlier, so Virginia wasn't ready. By 1849, the residents of the valley were extremely eager to be connected by rail with the rest of the state, but the Louisa Railroad lacked the funds. Therefore, on March 5th, 1849, the General Assembly chartered the Blue Ridge Railroad Company, a corporation owned entirely by the state of Virginia. This company was charged with laying the 17-mile stretch of track that will connect Blair Park near Meacham's River in Albemarle County to Waynesboro in the Shenandoah Valley. Once the line was built, so this is up over the mountains, once the line was built, the operation would be under the direction of the Louisa Railroad. By 1850, this organization changed its name to the Virginia Central Railroad Company. By the end of the summer of 1849, Crozet had finished the necessary surveys. Having decided to pierce the Blue Ridge at Rockfish Gap, Crozet's biggest task was devising a way to lay the tracks up to the gap on the eastern slope on our side. The foothills undulated, as we all know. They still do, leaving no apparent natural approach. There we are again, the problem with the past tense. The western side of the Blue Ridge had no such problem, as y'all are familiar from traveling over to Waynesboro. From the western portal of the proposed Blue Ridge Tunnel, the tracks would be able to follow a gentle descending slope to the valley floor. Crozet's solution was to dig three tunnels on the Albemarle County side. The first one, just west of Greenwood Station, would be 536 feet long and arched throughout with brick. The second tunnel, called Brooksville, would be a single-track tunnel, 864 feet long. The third tunnel, known as Little Rock, would be only 100 feet long. So three more tunnels leading up to the big one. By comparison, the Blue Ridge Tunnel, when completed, was 4,264 feet long, four-fifths of a mile, right? For the design of the massive Blue Ridge Tunnel, Crozet chose an elliptical shape, an ellipse, 12 feet high, 12 feet wide, and 17 feet tall. It conformed to the railroad cars then in use and still left room along the sides of the tracks for workmen. There was just enough room up top to accommodate smokestacks and provide for ventilation. The Blue Ridge Tunnel rose slightly going east to west, water would drain from the eastern portal while the engine smoke would escape from the west. Bids were solicited for the construction of the Blue Ridge Tunnel and its approaches as 1849 came to a close. The Board of Public Works finally awarded a contract in February of 1850 to John Kelly, Christian E. Detwald, and John Largy. They believed they could drill the hole under Rockfish Gap in 3 years at the cost of approximately $200,000. Kelly and company had already assembled the workforce, but before the work could begin, a small Irish revolution broke out. A large number of Irish workmen from County Cork were encamped at Rockfish Gap. To help with the construction of the road, John Kelly brought down from New York a large party of Far Downers, people from the north of Ireland. They came up the valley with their wives and children and set up camp near Fishersville. The Corkonians greatly resented the presence of the Far Downers, and on February 2nd, 1850, 235 of the men of Cork marched against them. In the huge fracas that ensued, the Far Downer shantytown was completely burned to the ground. Local militiamen were called out to stop the affair, and a number of Corkonians were arrested. According to Augusta authorities, the men of Cork, in their defense, said that they just wanted to have a little fight. Those Irish. And I can say that I'm part Irish, part Irish. Work on the approaches to the Blue Ridge Tunnel began in April of 1850. The bore itself was begun in August. The big tunnel was started from both ends simultaneously, about 400 feet below Rockfish Gap. The Irish gangs went at the granite and quartz with picks and hand drills. As the tunnels bored into the earth, the dirt and loose rocks were carried out on the backs of mules. Black powder was even used occasionally. The explosions would roll out across the counties of Albemarle, Nelson, and Augusta. The boring was pushed forward each day by 3 8-hour shifts, constant work. Even so, the workmen averaged a daily penetration of only 2 feet. 2 feet a day. Soon after the drilling began, it became evident to Crozet that Kelly and his partners had bid way too low. Detwall left the firm. Kelly and Largy signed a new contract in March of 1851, agreeing to complete the work if the state picked up all the expenses. The contractors were to receive a fixed fee of $20,000, which would be reduced by 2% on any excess over and above the said expenditure of $200,000. Kelly and Largy, therefore, would earn only $16,000 if the cost of the tunnel stretched out to $400,000. The final cost of the Blue Ridge Tunnel to the state of Virginia would be $488,000, so 2.5 times what they had bid originally. Labor unrest broke out again in 1853. Newly arrived workers who had witnessed tunneling in Cincinnati reported that the pay back up there was $1.50 a day. The Irishmen at the Blue Ridge Tunnel were sweating a long day for half that amount, 75 cents a day. Now they demanded $1.50. The Irish at both portals went on strike, posting signs warning strike breakers to look out for shanty powder and ball. In other words, you try to break this strike and we're going to shoot you. Crozet was sympathetic to the Irish, but also believed in using a strong hand. At his insistence, Governor Joseph Johnson ordered a Stanton Light Infantry Company to stand ready. In the end, Father Daniel Downey kept the Irish tempers calmed. Kelly offered the strikers $1.25. A large number of disgruntled workers left to go up to Cincinnati, where it was $1.50 a day and better pay, but work on the Blue Ridge Tunnel continued. As work on the big tunnel dragged on, the residents of the Shenandoah Valley grew tired of waiting around. In late 1853, a temporary track was laid down over the mountain at Rockfish Gap. The curves were sharp and the inclines were steep, but a special engine was used. The Lexington Gazette reported that the climber, an engine of unusual weight and construction to be employed in carrying over the mail and passenger trains, will pass up today or tomorrow. The road carried the first train to Stanton on March 20, 1854. The Valley of Virginia was finally connected with Richmond and points east. The boring of the tunnel continued as the powerful locomotives chugged overhead. An outbreak of cholera attacked the ramshackle shantytowns in the summer months of 1854, as if they don't have enough trouble, right? At the eastern encampment, 25 of 150 inhabitants died. On the western side of Rockfish Gap, 8 more Irishmen were struck down. As a result, the workers scattered in fear and progress halted for several weeks. The depreciation of Virginia bonds in 1855 almost ceased work on the big tunnel altogether. Each month, the state would issue bonds equal to the amount of Kelly's expenses. Those bonds would be sold by a bank that would turn over the funds to the contractors. When the bonds were sold at a discount, Kelly and his partner were taking in less than they were spending. Determined to finish the job at whatever cost, John Kelly threw in his own money. Almost $9,000 was finally repaid to him by the state, but in 1873, years later. By the mid-1850s, Claude Roset must have begun wondering if the job would ever end. Because the eastern portal was downhill, water would accumulate at the heading. The first solution was to pump the water out with homemade pumps manned by watermen. Finally, Crozet devised a siphon system that would stretch almost to the center of the tunnel. The 3-inch diameter pipe could pass 60 gallons of water per minute. This guy's a brilliant engineer. I mean, no question about it. Getting the water out of the tunnel was not Crozet's only problem, however. Fresh air had to be supplied to the headings, and the clouds of black powder smoke had to be sucked out. Never one to shy away from a challenge, Claude Crozet adapted a ventilation machine commonly used in coal mining at the time. The headings of the two tunneling operations finally met, and I know y'all are relieved. They're finally completing this. I can see the look on your faces. Finally met under Rockfish Gap on December 29th, 1856. They were only a half inch off. Is that amazing or what? Claude Crozet had good reason to celebrate, but it would still be 16 long months before the first train would finally roll through. On April 13th, 1858, the first train pierced the hole at Rockfish Gap. Although taking 5 years longer than anticipated, the Blue Ridge Tunnel was still a bargain for the people of Virginia. The total cost to the public, as I told you before, $488,000, or approximately $114 per running foot. Because of the overage, Kelly and company were paid only $14,000. In completing the huge task, Crozet endured every kind of problem, setback, and calamity imaginable. The most unbearable, though, was the constant stream of abuse heaped upon him by the press. They were unhappy over the slow progress of the work. They were insulted when he refused to consider well-intentioned suggestions. Armchair engineers, right? They also questioned his yearly salary, which was $3,000. Through it all, Claude Crozet worked diligently and in the end produced a public work of enduring utility. And perhaps his greatest tribute is that the Blue Ridge Tunnel remained in use by the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad until April 12, 1844. Almost 100 years, folks. 90 years. 1944. What did I say? Oh, I'm sorry. 19. I blew my own thing. 1944. Almost 90 years. 88 years. While the Virginia Central Railroad was plying its way westward into the Shenandoah Valley, another company was laying track into the Piedmont from the north. Yes, ma'am? The tunnel is not used. No, it's closed up on both sides. Yep. What's that? Yep, it's closed up. The Orange and Alexandria ran southwest through Manassas, Culverton, and Culpeper into Orange. In 1854, they extended their rails south into Gordonsville. By a special arrangement, the Orange and Alexandria leased the use of the Virginia Central's Gordon to Charlottesville link in order to reach into Albemarle County. From Charlottesville in 1855, the Orange and Alexandria began laying down tracks toward Lynchburg, 60 miles or so to the southwest, more than 60 miles, more like 70. This connection was completed in 1860. Yes, ma'am?
The trains go over the mountain now?
No. They don't go over the mountain anymore. They go through the mountain. So they dug another tunnel. In World War II, they dug another tunnel. Dug another tunnel right alongside Crozet's. They needed a bigger tunnel because the new trains are bigger. As our country's sectional crisis was heating up, therefore, Central Virginia was just getting accustomed to its relatively new network of iron rails. The long freight trains chugged east and west between the Valley and Hanover junctions on alternate days. First and second class passengers rolled through Charlottesville every day in both directions. Accommodations for both classes were identical, but at fueling points, those in first class could watch in elegant leisure as second class passengers helped load the wood. A good inducement to buy a first class ticket, wouldn't you say? Unless you want to get dirty loading wood. Passenger seats were usually hard wicker affairs that transferred every jolt and shock to the riders. Local newspapers offered advice on how to arrive safely. A favorite one was to travel huddled up in almost the shape of a ball, so any sudden stopping would roll the passenger rather than slam him against seats or the walls. Stagecoaches weren't any better. They were worse. At the time, riding the railroad on hard surface wicker chairs may have seemed a hardship for Virginians, but a multitude of unspeakable hardships were soon to come. War clouds were on the horizon. Thank you. Boy, I thought we would never finish that tunnel, huh? I could see the look on y'all. Boy, when is he going to finish that tunnel? Last I heard, and I've been up to the I heard what they were thinking about doing was opening it up. They have to clean it out and everything, and having a hiking trail through there. Now it's 4,200 feet, so I really believe that if they fix it up for a hiking trail, they're going to need cameras. They're going to need cameras, and they're going to need lights. I mean, because would y'all enter one end of a 4,200 foot tunnel not knowing who or what? I mean, it might be a bear in there, right? I mean, no, seriously, think about it. I mean, you don't know what's going to be inside the tunnel. So really, I kind of doubt that anything is going to be done with it. Another thing that they were talking about using, I think they used it for a while to store gas, to store dangerous gas. Is that right, Walt? Is that what you were going to say? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
So those people who give Crozet the credit for the tunnel that's there are wrong.
No. Why are they wrong?
I thought you said that they closed that one down.
They closed his down because it was too small. They had to build another one. But he deserves every credit in the world. The guy was amazing. Yeah. I mean, his was used for 88 years. That's tremendous. Yeah, Walt.
It's a key point in your canal. Waterway, railroad, conflict problem, because for Virginia, lots of rivers, but guess what's happening? The further upstream you go, the less navigable they are.
Right.
Not true in New York State.
Right.
You take
right.
Hudson River, you go up, you take a left-hand turn at the Mohawk, and guess what? There are locks on there now, but there didn't used to be. The Erie Canal gets you into Lake Ontario. So it's a totally different problem
right.
for Virginia to survive.
It's right.
got to do the railroads.
Right. But you know, I got really frustrated researching this because they keep stalling and they keep fighting it. You know, they're right. It was money.
What Walt was saying, the Erie Canal always had locks from
right.
the very beginning.
Right.
There was a 400-foot drop from
right.
Lake Erie to...
Right, and there are locks on the James River Kanawha Canal, too.
The difference is that there was a lot more water up there. The,
yeah.
The reliability of water in the James and Flubana,
right.
et cetera, is,
right.
is just not anywhere.
Well, and that's why they needed a canal.
Yeah.
Right,
but
right, it's not reliable.
The canal in the summertime, the...
Yeah, it's iffy, but yeah, uh-huh. But they had special races that divert the water from the river into the canal to try to keep it up. Yeah. I've seen it in different places, and you can see portions of the Rivanna Canal at Palmyra, When you come over the bridge into Palmyra, you look down and you can see part of the canal still there, and a lock sitting right there. Real similar to the ones to the ones built on the James River Kanawha Canal. You had a question, ma'am?
Yeah. In the controversy between the canal versus the railroad and the money involved, at the time, did the bigwigs who wanted the canals realize that they really would make more money if the railroads, because all the major cities would be connected?
That's a good point. But but think about it this way. And let's see if I can explain this the right way. Okay. Some of the biggest, in fact, all the biggest Virginia cities at the time were on the rivers because they were built along the rivers on purpose because that was the main transportation system. So these guys representing those cities in the legislature are just playing to their constituents, right? The constituents want that traffic to continue on the river. They don't know, but think about this too. They don't know that they're all going to be connected by railroad. But what they fear is it'll connect some of these smaller places that don't deserve to be connected. And those places, like Charlottesville, bear with me now, I know people are laughing. Those places are going to become more important because they are connected by railroad. Now, how is that fair to Richmond or Norfolk or Fredericksburg if Gordonsville all of a sudden is as important as Fredericksburg? See, they don't like that. So they're doing what their constituents want, all those businessmen in those river side cities, they want that traffic to continue on the river. See? They had bridges over the rivers there. But yeah, but they're not thinking forward, and you know, they're resisting. We, you know, and I didn't want to say this, but they're the old, you know, the old jokes in about, you know, about Virginians being stodgy. And this is the perfect example of holding the line against invention and against newfangled things. You know, there's plenty of those jokes about Virginians. And I'm a Virginian, so I get to say that. Yep.
And in the same line, I understand that people who got a little railroad, they don't want to connect to you. They want their own privacy.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, exactly. And that's exactly right. That's a good point. And that's what kept the focus at first on these smaller lines. And why should they do the same gauge as the guy on the next line? Why should they cooperate? So what that meant is in a lot of towns, you got two different stations. Yeah, and you have to get off of one. Yeah, I mean, even in big places like Baltimore, you get off of one, then you have to go across town and get on the other one because the gauges don't match. Why should they cooperate? And, you know, that same kind of stuff is happening nowadays between technology companies. Why should they cooperate? Right? Right?
They still switch engines in D.C.
They still, right? Yeah. Right. 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 You had a question back here? I'll get you in a minute. Hold on. Yes?
That was just a big problem during the Civil War because the North
right.
standardized the
gauge. Right. The South. Right. And speaking of the Civil War, I think I remember that and it shows all the different gauges, a lot of different gauges in the South. But the thing to remember to give you an idea is the difference in population in millions between North and South in the Civil War, so it's about 32, 33 million in the United States, about a tenth of what we are now, 33 million or so. 22 million in the North, 11 million in the South, 4 million of those people are slaves. But it's the same proportion in thousands of miles of railroad track. So about 33,000 miles of railroad track in the United States, 22,000 of them in the North, a lot more. In the North, only about 11,000 in the South. It's a really similar statistic. Isn't that interesting? Let me get her back there. Yes, you had a question?
Companies like the one that won the job of creating the tunnel ever own slaves instead of using hired labor?
I don't think any slave labor was used on the tunnel, on Crozet's tunnel, but plenty of other railroads, I'm sure, were built with slave labor or repaired with slave labor. I mean, I don't see there any hesitant. It may be, you know, I'll have to look this up, but maybe it's due to Crozet that he didn't use slave labor. And, you know, this is going to sound kind of crass, but it might have been cheaper to use the Irish than this. I know, honestly, it might actually have been cheaper to use the Irish. Yep. Yes?
They did have to use, they preferred the Irish as opposed to using the black slaves, because using the black slaves under those circumstances, it would have been too expensive if one of them had been killed.
Right, exactly. You have to pay the owner. Right.
They don't always get somebody to replace them.
Hold on a second. Yep. Her statement is, and it's a great one, is that, yeah, the slaves were more expensive because if one of them got injured or, God forbid, died, then they would have to pay the value to the owner, which might be at this time $1,000, $2,000. So that would set them back. And who's going to pay anything to the Irish family when the Irishman dies? Nobody.
I was just going to ask, this is a bit obvious.
They did. She's asking if they had the same problem with gauges throughout the southern states. They did. And the reason I know that is from studying the Civil War. It was a constant problem in transferring supplies and troops and everything. Yeah, they had it throughout the South. Absolutely, yes. And I'll get you in a moment. When did the northern states go to one gauge? And you're saying they didn't?
They didn't. They had two gauges.
Okay, two gauges in the northern states?
Narrow gauge and a regular gauge.
Narrow gauge and regular gauge, right.
Narrow gauge was used for all the local lines, and regular gauge was for the shipping.
Yep.
Up north, they invented a machine engine with wheels that would run on both.
That would run on both gauges?
With wide wheels. It would fit on either, you can switch one
to
the other if you have to.
That's using the noodle, huh? There you go. There you go. Sure. Sure. And here I thought you y'all weren't interested because I thought you got bored of how long that story took, and you're asking all these great questions. So I feel a whole lot better now. I'm feeling a whole lot better. Yes, ma'am.
She answered it. It was Crozet named for Crozet.
It absolutely is. Yeah. Would you believe me if I said it wasn't? Obviously it is. Yeah. Yep. Claudius Crozet Park. Right. Right. Yep. Yeah, Bev?
Charlottesville, the crossroad between the CNO and the Southern. We had two stations. I thought that was much later. Do you know when that happened, or what did he have?
Yeah, I think the stations, those stations are from like the 1880s. And it was at the time it would have been the Orange and Alexandria and the Central Virginia. The Virginia Central and the Orange back then, but those names have changed. Right, right. But, so by 50, when did I say the ONA went through? By 56, Charlottesville was a crossroads. And thanks to that fact, we got things in the Civil War like the Confederate General Hospital, because of the importance of it being a railroad intersection. Yeah. Which meant you could get to Charlottesville pretty easily from other parts of the state. Right. You have another question?
Yes.
Okay.
Did Crozet just come to this country to get away from the revolution in France?
He came because at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, he didn't think there was much future in France. So he was looking for a new start. And he was still pretty young. So he came to the United States. And we're lucky to have him, really. Did a really good job. You're welcome. Any other questions? Well, thanks, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.